All right. Hi, everybody. It's RCFB Talk 55. My name is Babak Hariri. I'm going to be joined by my co-host, Sirius, and we have a special guest today. We're going to have John Talty, senior sports editor and SEC insider at the Alabama Media Group, a.k.a. AL.com. He's got a new book coming out, The Leadership Secrets of Nick Saban, How Alabama's Coach Became the Greatest Ever. It's coming out on the 9th, actually, so it's coming out real soon. This is a really interesting book. We've had a chance to read a bit of it. John's obviously, he's an interesting character, but this actual book is utterly fascinating. It's the bits we read it made us want to read more. So he's going to be joining us shortly, and we're going to also have opportunity to talk about questions from yourselves. If you have questions about either the book, SEC football, whatever, we'd love to hear from you as well. So he's going to be joining us here. All right, great. So John, you're up here.
I'm here.
So excellent. I gave your introduction at the very beginning, but just in case those of you joining us late, this is John Talty. He's senior sports editor and SEC insider at the Alabama Media Group, aka AL.com. Don't read the comments. Sorry. And he's the author of this really interesting book that's come out. It's about to come out, pardon me. The Leadership Secrets of Nick Saban, How Alabama's Coach Became the Greatest Ever. It's coming out on August 9th. I read an excerpt of it. I really was rapt by all of it. But John, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, I really appreciate you having me. Really excited for what I think should be a fun conversation and excited to dig in here.
Absolutely. You know, the thing that struck me from what I read was from your writing, it sounds like Saban's commitment and focus on recruiting is utterly incredible. It's such an intense kind of psychological and emotional connection. If you told me that he loved recruiting, like actually genuinely loved it, I would believe you after reading some of what you wrote.
Yeah, and I think what's interesting is because I think that he does, and I think he in particular loves the competition around it. But there is a quote in there that I did really enjoy. It was, kind of a little bit of the other side of the coin and offered the opinion of that. It's not that he loves recruiting, it's just that he knows exactly what is needed to be done, and that's what he will value above all else. And so I think whether he loves it or not, he certainly knows that it's critical to the operation to recruit at a high level. I think he realized very early on that if you don't have the right players, doesn't matter how great of an X's and O's coach you are, you're not going to win at the level he wants to win at. And so I think what I love about that chapter, and you can read the excerpt on AL.com or you can look at my Twitter feed, and I've tweeted about it a couple times. But what I love about it is that he establishes literally from day one at Alabama, first meeting, he tells everyone in the organization, our number one priority moving forward is going to be recruiting. It all has to be built around that. And I think that says a lot about who he is, that he not only did that, but also that he felt it was important for not just the coaches, but also the secretaries, the custodial workers, everybody to be at that meeting to understand what the organization's top priority was.
You talk to a lot of Coach Saban's past colleagues, subordinates, and support staff, put this book together, from Alabama to LSU, Michigan State to even Toledo when he was there for that season. How many interviews do you estimate you had when you were putting this book together?
Yeah, it was more than 100, and some of them are quoted by name. Some people just wanted to talk either off the record or on backgrounds, and so that's kind of it's all that. And then I think what helped me was that I wasn't starting from at ground zero here. I've covered the SEC, I've covered Alabama, for years now, and so it helped that I was able to either remember things that people have told me over the years, or things that I maybe have never used before that I had just kind of in a filing cabinet, basically. I was able to tap into some of that stuff as well, which gave me an advantage, I think, when writing this book. But I tried to talk to a wide swath of people, and so I could get different perspectives, and I can talk to I talked to former players, former coaches, people again that were offensive coordinators, people that were graduate assistants. I talked to, some rival coaches. I remember one of them was Mark Richt, and talking about, kind of what it was like facing Saban. What did he see that Alabama was doing? And so just try to get as many different voices as possible to try to give as fully formed of a perspective on Saban as possible.
Of those, which were some of the more intriguing ones, or were there some that you didn't expect?
I think one of the things that I learned while writing this book is that I think sometimes whether it's writing a book or writing a story or doing a TV package, whatever it might be, we think about, okay, Nick Saban, let me think about somebody famous who knows Nick Saban. And so, and Lane Kiffin is quoted in this book, right? And Lane Kiffin's fun, but Lane Kiffin is somebody that everybody goes to talk about Nick Saban. And so I think a lot of Kiffin's stories, at least the ones he wants to tell publicly, have already kind of been told at this point. And so I think the people that I most enjoyed talking to were probably people that you've never even heard of because their stories have never been told before. Those are the people that I thought had some of the more interesting anecdotes and stories about their time with Nick Saban, because I think I kind of realized that these guys have probably wanted to tell their stories and no one's ever asked them before. Whereas some of the more high-profile guys who I did interview, they had great perspectives, no doubt, but some of their stories, you might have read somewhere before, you might have heard that somewhere before. And one of my top priorities with this book was that I wanted the hardcore Alabama college football SEC fans to find things in this book that they have never read or heard before. And that took finding some of these people under the radar who you probably don't know that much about.
John, you've covered Alabama football before. Was there an interview that brought out something that it was totally different from what you thought you knew about Nick Saban? Some little anecdote or something, and you're like, wow, I would not have guessed that.
Yeah, there's a few. I think having been around Alabama for a while now, I feel like I had a pretty good sense of who he was as a person. But I do think that he's framed publicly as a robot in many ways. I think it's changed a little bit in the last few years because he's allowed himself to be a little less guarded publicly. I think you're seeing a little bit more of that side of him. But I think for many years, he was just framed as this robot who's obsessed with winning, and that's all that matters. And let's not, make any mistake about it. He absolutely wants to win. He does work really hard. He is incredibly hard charging. But I thought some of the stories that people told me of maybe the not softer side, but more the more human side of Saban that you don't see publicly were some of the ones that I found really interesting. And one story in particular I thought was really interesting and told me a lot. And that's it's in this chapter about how Saban's evolved over the years. And back in 2015, there was this running back, former Alabama running back. His name was Alti Tenpenny. And he was part of the famous Alabama running back room that also had Derrick Henry and Alvin Kamara. And he ultimately decided to transfer out. He had gotten in trouble with a couple of things. Saban essentially wanted him to sign a contract, like, you're going to live your life this way. You're not going to do these things. Tenpenny didn't want to do that. Transferred to UNLV, was there not very long. Transferred to Nicholls State, was not there very long. And then was, driving from Nicholls State back to his home in Arkansas one day. And he falls asleep at the wheel, crashes, and dies. And that moment hit Saban really hard. And it's not just because Tenpenny was a popular player and his team was very devastated. I mean, Derrick Henry and Kenyon Drake in particular were very, very saddened by that loss. But I think it prompted something in Saban that made him realize, like, I really love this kid. And he probably never knew that I felt that way about him because I was pushing him so hard to try to do these different things. And multiple players around that time at Alabama told me that they saw a change in Saban after that, tragic loss of Tenpenny. They saw him joke around a little more. They saw him smile a little more. It just seemed like he realized, I can't just be this essentially hard-ass football coach. Like, I have to at least show a little bit more of myself as a human being for these guys to know that it's not personal and that it's really, I'm just trying to make them as best of a player in person as I can. And so I think that was an important moment for Saban that I didn't realize at that time the importance of. And it was really talking to players and coaches around that time that told me the changes they saw in him after that, that event.
You brought up something interesting with this story, and I know how important it is and a part of your book, the evolution of his leadership style. So how would you characterize his leadership now, his leadership style now, compared to, say, when he first arrived at Alabama? And perhaps, I mean, if you can reach back to some of those other stops he had. I mean, it's fascinating to wonder what he was like, particularly in those early years, taking over at Toledo, going to the NFL, coming back to go to Michigan State, and how that kind of development that most leaders, obviously successful leaders like himself, seem to display that ability to move with the times or at least learn and refine.
Yeah, absolutely. And so the first chapter of the book actually starts at his time at Toledo. And I thought it was really important to hit on exactly what you're talking about there, to show the evolution that of, you know, a 38-year-old first-time head coach to, you know, where we are now, what we see him as now. And I mean, you can imagine, think about what we see of Saban now. We know he's a hard worker. We know he, you know, can be a bit of a hard ass. You can imagine a 38-year-old Nick Saban who hasn't accomplished anything and what that guy might have been like. And I can assure you, he was a hard-charging guy. I mean, some of the guys on that staff, I mean, just the stuff that he was doing. I mean, he was in your face. He would literally get in your face and yell at you. And he was all one speed. And I think he was still at that time, it was a lot of a one-size-fits-all approach. I mean, he is such a – I think he's so intrinsically motivated to be the best that at that time, I don't think he understood why guys weren't wired the same way, whether it's as his coaches or, you know, as players. You know, one of the guys he battled with a lot during that time, this guy Dan Williams, ended up being a first-round pick, and he just couldn't understand why this guy wasn't working harder, why he didn't want to maximize his skills. And one of my favorite anecdotes in the book is actually around that Toledo time. And so Nick Saban calls his running back coach on Christmas Day, and he's like, "Hey, LC, like, what are you up to, man?" And you know, the LC is like, "I'm like, it's Christmas morning, like I'm hanging out with my wife right now." And Saban says, "You want to come over and watch some film?" And he was dead serious. And the guy was like, no, I don't want to watch film with you on Christmas morning. Like, my wife's going to kill me if I leave and tell her that I'm watching film with you. But he was dead serious. And that guy told me that Saban used to give him crap about it after the fact. Like, "Oh, you just listen to whatever your wife wants. Like, you wouldn't even come watch film with me on Christmas." Like, that's how absolutely wild he was at that time. And I think as time has gone on, and of course, success helps when it's a little easier when you've already won 7 national championships to get guys to buy in, to get the recruits you want, all those different things. But it took him time, I think, to realize what the right pace was. And most importantly, and this is something that a lot of people have told me about Saban, he's very good at knowing how to motivate different kinds of people. I think he's very good at knowing this guy needs a kick in the butt, this guy needs a hug. But that took years for him to develop those skills and really tap into kind of the human psyche and the psychology to know you can't just give everybody the same approach.
Do you think that he's had to adjust his coaching style in terms of staff management now that he's been at Bama and he's had kind of that revolving door of assistants and coordinators because people keep trying to poach his staff away from him whenever he has a successful season?
So I think one of the smart things that he did that I think was, you know, ahead of the curve, and you've seen it be copied throughout college football now, is when he started hiring these former, you know, basically failed head coaches and offensive coordinators as analysts. And so what that allowed him to do, not only to get these guys at a major discount, you know, I think Butch Jones is a great example. They paid Butch Jones, I think, $35,000 a year because Tennessee is still paying him millions of dollars. And so here you get former Tennessee head coach to be as an analyst and do whatever you want. But where it really helped too was that that gave a guy like, say, a Billy Napier, who was an analyst, he's behind the scenes for a year. He gets to learn the system. He gets to learn the terminology, the playbook, all those different things. And so when he does have someone leave, he's got a great candidate already on staff who already has a heads up, an advantage over anybody he might bring from outside. And so you saw that run from Napier, Mike Locksley, Steve Sarkisian, all these guys who started as analysts that he was able to then promote to an on-field staff role because they already had some time, you know, to learn the system. But one of the other things that I think he does very smart in regards to that, and I'll use Bill O'Brien as an example, he hires Bill O'Brien as an offensive coordinator. This guy, you know, a year earlier was an NFL head coach, obviously a very accomplished guy. He's got his way of doing things. And when he gets to Alabama, he doesn't let Bill O'Brien bring all of his terminology that he's been using. He says, "You need to learn our terminology and figure out how to put it into your system," because they didn't want, with all the turnover that they have with coaches, you didn't want to have to make 45, 50 players, if not more, have to learn new terminology every single year. It's no, this is our system. I'd rather have one person have to learn than make 50 kids have to learn it all over again. And so that, I think, is really smart. And it also takes humbleness from a guy like Bill O'Brien to have to say, okay, you're right, I need to now learn how you guys do things and not just bring what's been successful for me at other places.
When, you know, he was at, I mean, to go back a little bit earlier in his career, because obviously we already talked about how successful recruiting is and how much of a big part that is to his success and how he, I think, frames success. I know you had that, again, that comment where he says, you know, I'm not the greatest coach, but I'm an exceptional recruiter, or, you know, when he was first arriving at Alabama, sort of self-effacing. But now people know what he's all about. But how did he handle recruiting when he was just starting out as a head coach? You know, I know obviously he had to recruit heavily as an assistant, but when he was at Michigan State in those early years, how was he pitching to recruits when he doesn't have the track record he does now?
Yeah, and I think that, I mean, I think somewhat of it is a similar pitch, but I think he had to, you know, take more chances on guys. I think he had to accept some players that he certainly wouldn't accept now at Alabama. I mean, I think he had to realize, and that's something that I talked to some guys about, was that I think early on, especially, it was hard for Saban, I think especially at Toledo, to, you know, to not have too high of a standard. And I think that was challenging for him because he knew what was necessary, but then it didn't always equate to what he was able to get at that level. I think after working with Bill Belichick with the Browns, I think really helped set him up for future success, in which it wasn't just about what this guy couldn't do. It's like, what could this guy do for us? And I think it changed his framework to some extent. And of course, you know, he now uses these things called the statement sheets, in which he has essentially a formula that he uses, that he's trying to, you know, find these guys that fit the formula based on previous success and previous guys he's had in his system. But it was undoubtedly harder at Michigan State than it was at either LSU or Alabama. But I think when you talk to these guys who have been recruited by him, he just has this genuine message that really resonates with people, where he'll tell them, you know, we're going to try to accomplish X, Y, Z. And these guys really believe him. And it took some years to get that rolling at Michigan State, but there was a good amount of buy-in from the get-go. And you saw that, you know, really come to a head, you know, at the end of 98. And then of course, 99, before he leaves, when he really finally has that talent that he needed at a high enough level to compete, you know, with the Big Ten's top teams.
And now Julio Jones was a good example of a pivotal moment in recruiting and also setting the tone within Alabama. Could you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, Julio Jones, I think, is a great example of the Saban recruiting approach, because he gets to Alabama and, you know, there's some talented players on that team that end up playing an important role in that 2009 national championship team. But it was not a team stacked with talent by any means. People told me for the book that, you know, Shula loved to just, you know, sign in-state kids, which made everybody around the state happy. But, you know, those kids weren't necessarily producing at a level that was necessary for Alabama to be at the top of the SEC. So he gets to Alabama and he knows right away, I've got to get this guy, Julio Jones. There's a fun anecdote in the book where one of his GAs is, you know, they're going through all the different guys they want to target, and he's putting on, all right, next up, we got Julio Jones. He's going to put the tape in, and Saban stops him. He's just like, listen, man, just because I was in Miami the last couple of years, like, I already know who Julio Jones is. Like, that guy's ready to go right now. Like, let's go on to the next guy. I don't need to see his film. And so he knew from the day one, I have to get Julio Jones. But what I think he did that was really smart and really resonated with Julio was that he never promised him anything. He never said, you're going to be my star from day one. You're going to be the guy we build our entire offense around, the way that other schools were recruiting him. He basically directly challenged Julio and said, I'd love to win with you, but I do know that I will win without you. And I think that challenged Julio in a way that he loved. I think he loved the idea of the fact that Saban wasn't promising him anything, that he was challenging him. And it comes back to this overall Saban recruiting ethos of don't offer anything but an opportunity. That's what it always comes back to. He will tell players, you have an opportunity to do these things if you come here. You have an opportunity to win a national championship, to end up and go on and be a starter, be an NFL player, but I'm not promising you any of those things, and I'm certainly not promising you a starting position. And what that does, it almost self-selects incredibly motivated and competitive people who say, oh, you're not going to promise me anything? All right, I'll show you how I do things and I'll make you have to give me something. And it just leads to this incredibly competitive environment where all these guys know that they have nothing promised and that they're going to have to work their butts off for anything they get. And it really brings the best out of them.
You mentioned Miami. Was there a shift in Saban's philosophy or mentality from his time at LSU to his time at Bama that was influenced by that stint with the Dolphins?
Well, I think he realized, I mean, you could say from a big picture standpoint, I think he realized that he was best suited for the college game, you know, while he was, you know, at Miami and wanted to get back. There's even a thing in a little kind of tidbit in the book about how he was even interested in going back to LSU at that time. But, you know, I think they were in year three of Les Miles, or about to be in year three of Les Miles, and they didn't want to make a move that fast. But he was interested in coming back to the college game. I think one thing that he learned, and I don't know if it's simply from, you know, working with the Dolphins and seeing the outside influences, or if it was influenced by LSU or whatever you might say, but when he got to Alabama, I think he was very clear in establishing expectations, not only for obviously everyone who worked for him, which is detailed throughout the book, but also the outside factor people. You know, there's some famous stories, which have been written about, I think, over the years, where he basically sat down some of these top boosters and said, listen, like, I need your money, I need your support, but also, like, basically need you to get out of the way. You know, like, I will give you what you guys want. I'm going to win, and I'll deliver you guys the national championships and all that stuff that you want. Like, I'm not going to all your golf events. I'm not going to every booster dinner and stuff like that. Like, if you want me to do what I think you guys want me to do, like, I need to do that. And I need you guys to get out of the way and stop messing around with stuff. And, you know, that's probably tough for some of these guys to hear. We can see across the country in college football, you know, boosters like to get involved, but it established early on, like, I am running the show here and, you know, I'm going to do things my way. And I think it allowed him to accomplish a lot of great things and limited some of the outside influence that seems to plague some of these other programs around the country.
He definitely seems to have a total commitment to seeing exactly what goes in and what goes out of the kitchen, so to speak. Because you sometimes will see top chefs who are standing right there at the front of the kitchen, seeing what's going in as an order, what's coming out. And it's sort of that sort of analogy struck me when I was reading about how, you know, yes, his coordinators will put recruits that they would like to see, but ultimately Saban's got to see exactly who gets an offer and vet that decision. How intense is that? And how do his coordinators and assistants react to that level of control? I mean, because you could see how under certain leadership styles that could really create resentment. And how does he manage that?
Yeah, and I think that is one of the challenges, and I write about that in the book too. I think he is pretty good at finding that balance, because I think you could say, you know, you take a step back, you could say, man, like, he's really kind of meddling there. Like, he's really getting in the weeds. How is he able to, you know, manage the big picture stuff if he's getting so in the weeds on that stuff? And what it is like, he's not getting in the weeds on all of it. You know, I write about in that chapter, you know, he's got all these recruiting analysts and things like that digging up all these little details. You know, they're scouring the internet to find out what kind of, you know, what a guy's favorite cereal is. Like, Saban's not doing that, but he'll use that information that gets passed up the chain. But I mean, I think it's something that I think does frustrate guys at times. But the thing that, you know, probably frustrates them, one of the guys, I don't think that I put this in the book, but one of the guys who I talked to told me, like, one of the frustrating things with Saban sometimes is that, like, he's almost always right. And so, like, you might get annoyed about what he's doing, or you might get annoyed about how he delivers the message to you. But you take a step back and you're like, you know what? Like, damn, this guy was right. Like, and that almost kind of bothers you even more that, like, you really don't have that much to push back on him with because he's right about it. And, you know, in that excerpt, Glenn Mason, the former Minnesota and Kansas coach, you know, told me, like, listen, this is basically the best talent evaluator I've ever seen. Like, his eyes are incredible. And he, you know, he sees stuff that I couldn't see. And so, if you're a recruiter, you know, you want your guy, you're saying, this is my guy, we got to get him. But, you know, I think at this point, especially, Saban's track record speaks for itself. So if Saban's saying, like, listen, man, I just don't see it, he's not a take for me, of course you're going to be frustrated by that. But, like, I mean, it's hard to really argue with the guy's track record. I mean, he's, of course, missed on players before, but he doesn't miss that often. And, you know, it's something that those guys just have to accept. But I will say within that as well, like, Saban's very clear, and I think this is a running theme throughout the book, and I think it's a running theme throughout the Alabama organization. he's very clear about his expectations and he's very clear about what job responsibilities are. And so he'll tell people when he hires them, listen, like, this is not, we're not all freelancing here. Like, I need you to use your skills to do things the way that I want them done. So these guys know going in, like, they're not going to always get to do it exactly the way they want to. Like, he wants it done a very specific way, and they'll either do it the way he wants them to do it, or, you know, they can look for opportunities elsewhere.
What do you think is one of the biggest misses he's had, whether that's a player that they under-evaluated that turned out to exceed their expectations, or a guy who, you know, had all the measurables they wanted, but, you know, just didn't feel like a system kind of fit?
You know, they had a run in which they had multiple five-star defensive linemen, guys who are ranked, you know, like top 20 or so in the country, and multiple of them missed. And unfortunately, with a couple of them, I think there were some, you know, some mental health issues there. And that's something that you can't necessarily know or see until you get a guy on campus. And so, you know, I think there were, I don't even really want to say their names because I don't want to call these kids out, but, you know, you could Google and figure out who some of their misses were in terms of those five-star defensive linemen. But I think one of the things that you know, you try to do all that you can to get as much information as possible. And so, you know, you have these guys in for summer camps, and you try to put them through the ringer, try to do all these different things, but sometimes you just can't know how a guy is truly going to react to not only the competitive environment at Alabama, but also just how tough it is. Like, there's no, you know, it's not like some of these schools. I went to University of Maryland, and University of Maryland gets a five-star recruit. Like, that guy's going to be the guy. He's going to be the clear alpha. You're a five-star at Alabama. You know, there's probably five others at your position that have been recruited over the last 4 or 5 years. And so it's really tough. And so some of these kids, I think, they're used to being the top dog at their high school. They're used to dominating people. And they get to Alabama, they can't dominate the way they used to, and they're getting passed on the depth chart. And that can be really challenging. You just don't know how a kid sometimes is going to react to that environment until he gets there. And so they've definitely had some misses over the years, which, again, nobody hits 1,000. But he has had a pretty good track record.
So this is RCFB Talk 55. We're talking with John Talty, who has – a book coming up really soon on the 9th, The Leadership Secrets of Nick Saban, How Alabama's Coach Became the Greatest Ever. John, do you have a little bit more time? Because we'd like to welcome anyone who has questions if John has more time for us.
Yeah, let's do it.
Excellent. While we wait for those to come in, and again, if you want to ask a question of John, just hit the request button and we will let you up. I just wanted to also ask, because he's so focused, obviously, on getting the recruits and keeping the program and keeping everything running to how he expects. Do other, like, basic parts of his life, I'm not saying, like, you know, things like hygiene, but like food, become sort of necessities that he has to deal with and just doesn't care about? How is that for him? I mean, are there quirks to that kind of appear in his life because he's just so focused on the thing that he enjoys, which is coaching?
Yeah, I mean, so he eats the same thing for breakfast every single day. You know, he's going to have about 2 cups of coffee, some oatmeal cream pies. He's going to watch the Weather Channel. He eats the same thing for lunch every single day. He's going to have a salad with some turkey slices, some, you know, tomatoes. There's actually a thing in the book. Somebody was telling me, you know, that Miss Terry, his wife, Terry Saban, would have to, you know, sometimes would do have lunch with him. It's one of his brief, you know, periods, essentially a break, I guess, during the day. And he would still be working during lunch, and she'd have to tell him, like, listen, like, Nick, you got to take a bite of food, man. Like, you got to get some protein in your body. I mean, I was thinking about this the other day. They do take the freshman class out on the lake summer before the season, before fall camp starts. And Nick Saban wears the same New York Yankees t-shirt every single year. Like, that's his boat t-shirt. You know, he wears the same thing every single time. He's just one of those guys who's very built on routine. And I don't think that's what makes him great. You know, I think I write about this in the book. Like, if you saw any of the Theranos stuff, you know, where Elizabeth Holmes, like, it's just so obsessed with copying Steve Jobs. Like, she's like, all right, well, I'm going to wear the same thing to work every single day and all these different things. Like, you see sometimes people try to copy that level of efficiency, but it's just one little thing I think that speaks to who Saban is that, you know, he is wanting to be as efficient as possible. And so if you eliminate the choice of what's for lunch, what's for breakfast, you know exactly what you're doing every single day before the day starts. Maybe it saves you 30 seconds, a minute, whatever, and that gives you a minute to do something else.
You know, I remember reading that he also gets quite specific about selecting movies for the team to watch. Why is that?
Yeah, so I was talking to Andy Staples the other day on his podcast, and he had a great line to me that, you know, that so Alabama Saban will cut down the movies now. He very rarely, I guess, lets them actually watch the full movie. And Andy told me that, you know, one of the staffers at one point told him, like, I don't think our kids actually know why they were trying to save Private Ryan, because it hasn't edited down so much that they didn't even know, like, really what the plot of it was. But he's big on using motivational films to try to motivate the team. And so
not sure if that was on our side. Sirius, can you hear me?
Yep, I can. My audio cut out for a second, though.
Okay, great. John, we lost you there for a moment. We can hear you now.
Yeah, sorry about that. It looks like I was getting a call from somebody. Sorry about that.
No worries.
I don't know where I cut off, but happy to go wherever from here.
Well, I mean, was there an incident with the ring that's been talked about with LSU?
Yeah, so that was probably one of the funnier details that I got as part of the book writing process. And so Saban, it's funny, Saban talks about this game still to today. So famously, LSU wins this game over Kentucky, the Bluegrass Miracle, as some of you might remember. And, you know, it ends on this crazy play, and, you know, the Kentucky coach had already gotten the Gatorade back, all these different things. And so the next week, LSU plays Alabama, and they just get absolutely crushed. And so Saban uses that game to today. I think he brought it up last year as an example of, just because you win doesn't mean everything is going well. And one of the challenges with winning is that guys might be less likely to make the necessary changes to actually be a winner. And so basically, they never should have won that game, but because they did and the way that they did, guys weren't listening to him that week when he was warning them what was to come, and that's why they lost. Well, the detail that hadn't been reported before this book, which I thought was absolutely hilarious, is that the night before that Alabama game that they get absolutely crushed in, Nick Saban does one of his team movie nights, and he takes them to see the horror movie The Ring. And if you've ever seen The Ring, like, you know, I'm trying to think how old I was when I saw that movie. Like, it's a pretty scary movie. You know, you got the girl crawling out of the screen and all that stuff. Like, it's pretty wild. And one of the guys from that team told me, like guys were legitimately, like, startled by that movie. Guys had nightmares about it that night. A couple starters didn't sleep well at all that night. And that these guys came in just, like, not ready to go for that game. They were kind of sleepwalking through it and got absolutely crushed. And so Saban loves to tell the story about how it was really the fault of, you know, the previous game. But some people point to the fact that, you know, seeing The Ring the night before that game did not help matters at all.
That really should be part of the promotion for The Ring, even now. I mean, it scared Nick Saban's team into a loss, or I don't know how you quite frame that, but that's great. You know, and incidentally, listening to you talk about how he wants people to do certain job descriptions, I'm trying to now imagine Nick Saban as an HR director writing, you know, job specifications to a level of precision that just crushes anyone else before him. You know, we have someone who wanted to ask a question. We let them up. Ike, can you just feel free to unmute yourself and ask a question?
Oh, absolutely. Hey, John, I'm really looking forward to the book. A lot of people are familiar with Ted Lasso and what he represents, and there are a lot of people who have incredible misconceptions about Coach Saban. So based off of what you've been able to observe and the things you were putting together, what are a couple of the things that Coach Saban has in common with Coach Lasso, and maybe something just really different?
Yeah, well, thanks for asking that question, and I'm excited for you to get a chance to read the book soon. So I think if I was going to, and I love Ted Lasso as well, so I'm trying to think on this on the spot here, but I think one of the most obvious ones for me, and I think one of my favorite scenes, I think it's probably a favorite scene for a lot of people, is in the dart throwing thing, in which he talks about, you know, being curious. And I think one of the things that Saban does the absolute best is that he is so curious. He's, you know, I talked to multiple guys who have given speeches to the team, and Saban will be sitting in the front row taking down like very detailed notes. He's always looking for any little edge he can get. He's a very well-read person. He's very interested in the human mind and the human psychology and trying to understand how to best reach people. And so I think that one of the traps that you see coaches fall into, especially when they've had a little bit of success, is, you know, hey, I've won X amount of games, whatever. This is my style. This is how it works. This is how we're doing it. And Saban's really not that way. He's constantly searching for any little edge that he can get. And one of the stories that I put in the book one of these guys told me when he was still an assistant coach that, you know, you would have these, you know, like these coaching clinic type things, right? Which, you know, you bring in a famous speaker, a bunch of coaches are there, and then everybody goes and grabs beers and hangs out afterward and they cut up and all that. And he told me, like, Saban would be like, he would find whoever that speaker was and he would just grill the guy for like an hour just to get any little detail he might be able to get to make him, maybe make him even 1% better, right? Now, in terms of the one big difference between Lasso and Saban, I mean, I think the obvious one to me is that I think Saban uses a little saltier language than Ted Lasso does. I think there might be a little bit more. I can't remember Ted Lasso cursing much on that show. If you've been around Nick Saban, he's a little more willing to let it fly. You know, I'm from Jersey. That doesn't personally bother me, but, you know, there's some bad language that gets thrown out from time to time that, you know, maybe couldn't make it onto an Apple Plus show. But I think that's
I think they let Coach Lasso loose in like the very last line of each season.
Yeah, there you go. So, you know, he gets maybe one or two in, whereas one of the stories that somebody told me, one of the guys who played for Shula and then Saban was like, I think he said something on the lines of like, I think, you know, I might have heard Mike Shula curse like once or twice an entire year. And he's like, I think the first practice of Saban, I think Saban cursed at every single one of us. And so there's just a little bit different of a style there in terms of the messaging. But I think that one of the things that people did tell me was that, like, you know, it's never personal how he kind of words that. He's just, you know, just kind of, he uses some words that, you know, probably not recommended for broadcast TV.
Well, Ike, thank you so much for joining us. If any of you out there have other questions, please feel free to just hit request. You know, John, you must have had so many good stories that didn't fit into the book. What was that process, that push and pull like with the editor on deciding what could stay in, and how tight did that get as you were getting towards finalizing this book for publication?
Yeah, and so, you know, Staples was giving me crap about it the other day that I didn't put the Zaxby story in the book, which I get, you know, if you guys didn't see, tweeted something about essentially how Nick Saban doesn't know what Zaxby's was. And it was a funny anecdote that people seem to like. I mean, I think there was a couple of things within that to answer your question. You know, one, like, listen, could I have written a 500-page book about Nick Saban? Absolutely. But the book is written very purposefully to be easily accessible to a wide swath of different people. I mean, I think that, you know, I think the hardcore, you know, I love the Sicko Committee stuff on Twitter. Like, I think for the hardcore Sicko fans of us, like all the people who love college football, there's going to be a lot in this book that you're going to love that you have never read or seen before anywhere. But I also wanted to write this book in a way that somebody who maybe isn't a hardcore college football fan, there's still enough in there that if they're just more interested in the business or leadership style of Saban, that they will still be able to read and enjoy this book, that it doesn't have every little X's and O detail that I was able to come up with in the book. So I wanted it to be able to be a book that you could read very easily. And so that required having to leave stuff on the cutting room floor. It is always a challenge, but I think that, you know, in terms of my job as an editor, I think back to when, you know, I work with people on different stories, the best stories usually have good stuff on the cutting room floor. If you felt like you had, you feel like you put every single great detail or every single even remotely good detail in the story, either the story is going to feel bloated or it's going to feel like you probably didn't do enough reporting that you have nothing left that we even can possibly cut. And so I try to think about it that way. And there's also just, you know, I think writing a book is, it's a lot like putting together a puzzle, in my opinion. And so sometimes you had what you thought was a good puzzle piece and you kept moving it around and moving around and ultimately it just didn't fit. And, you know, it just has to kind of get left out. And, you know, the great thing is that, you know, my day job is, you know, covering Alabama football and SEC. And I work with a team of reporters who are great at AL.com, who also cover Alabama, different things. And so some of the stuff that I didn't use for this book can still have value down the line and maybe a different story or a different, you know, idea.
You know, I like the way you were kind of explaining that. It reminds me, for example, you go on YouTube, you watch a deleted scene from a movie you really like, you know, even some classics like The Godfather or something like that. And you'll see people like, oh, this should have been kept in the movie. But then you sort of think, well, it might have broken the pace up. Yeah, sure, that little story or that little scene might have been neat. But the overall, you know, work might suffer. So that makes complete sense. You know, this is a question that I feel like everyone asks when asking about Nick Saban, particularly at this stage in his career. How long does he keep going for?
It is it's the billion-dollar question. It's the question that I easily get the most out of any question that I get. And it's, you know, I feel like sometimes I'm so in the weeds on this guy that I'm, like, inside his head that, like, I talk myself into different paths. But the kind of stock answer that I give at this point is that I think there are two potential things that could eventually lead him to leave. I think obviously one of the, you know, obvious ones is just the fact that, you know, he is 70 years old. He'll turn 71 on Halloween. At a certain point, we all slow down and, you know, you sometimes you can't deliver what you used to be able to deliver. And I think he is, of course, an incredibly motivated person. He has still an incredible amount of energy for a 70-year-old, but I think we all slow down at some point. And I think one of the things that Nick Saban really cares about is I think he has a lot of respect for what it takes to be successful. I think he knows from all of his experience and all the success he's had, what it takes day in and day out to be a champion, right? And I think, I could be wrong, you know, 5 years from now, 6 years from now, it could turn into a Bobby Bowden type situation where you're almost just hoping the guy retires because it feels weird. But I don't think it will, because I think at a certain point, he'll know, you know, if he's waking up in the morning and he's not fired up to get to the office, or if he's not fired up to lead a practice in August, because he loves that stuff, I think that's the point when he'll know it might be time for me to walk away, because he's still so passionate about it. And he's still obviously having so much success, has the number one recruiting class right now, by far the favorite to win the national championship this year. I think as long as he's able to maintain that success and maintain that daily commitment, he's going to want to keep doing it. But if that falls off, I think he has too much respect to want to be coaching, you know, 7-5, 8-4 type Alabama teams.
If he just had to suddenly change gears and do something else, what would be an ideal alternate career for him?
Well,
I'm trying to imagine what we could just pop him into and he'd be as successful as he is now.
Well, I think there's two things there, maybe three. I think the one thing people always talk about is, you know, if you ever created a football czar type thing, he would be great at that. And so if you wanted to, you know, really go down the line a couple years from now, say you buy into, you know, eventually there's going to be one super conference or whatever. Is he like the VP of football for that type thing, where he's able to, you know, put together rules and different things to, you know, guide this big football type thing? I think he would love to do something like that, and would keep him in the game to some extent. A lot of people have told me that you could plop this guy in as a CEO of a Fortune 500 company and he would be great at it. I don't know specifically what that one would be or what that business might be, but I think he does like the idea of leading a group of people. And I think if he was able to lead a group of very, you know, competitive, highly motivated people, I think he would get a lot of value out of that. And then the final piece of it is, and this has obviously been written about some from the book, but, you know, he just about 9 years ago was interested in potentially taking an ESPN job. And so I think whenever he does ultimately leave, there will be considerable media interest in doing something with him. If you've watched him on TV, he's very good. He's very good at explaining in very concise ways complicated topics. And I think in particular, you know, a college game day type role would be something that ESPN would pursue him for.
Do you think that the recent changes in terms of name, image, likeness, the transfer portal, things like that, are going to kind of maybe speed up that process where he just says, you know what, I'm tired of everything that's, you know, keeps changing and adapting? Or do you think at this point he's done it for so long and his process is so refined that whatever change that the college football industry makes, it's just going to, you know, he'll roll with it and he'll just slightly adapt whatever he's already doing because he's got that track record of success?
Yeah, and I think he's got a track record of adapting too, right? And I write about this in the book. You know, if you look at, you know, the complaints he had around the, you know, hurry up, no huddle, spread offense type stuff, and clearly he did not want the game to go that direction. He's a defensive-minded coach. But ultimately he saw how it was headed and said, okay, fine, if this is how you guys want to do it, not how I want to do it, but this is how you guys want to do it, I'm going to do it better than all of you. And then you flash forward, you know, 5-6 years later, and he's got this incredibly high-powered offense. He's got, you know, putting Heisman winners into the league. I mean, he's got all these top quarterbacks, so much different than how he won his national championships early on. I think, I mean, he's obviously very frustrated by the NIL stuff. There's no doubt about it. But I do think that, he almost needs stuff like that to motivate him. You know, I think he needs these new challenges. He'll complain about them, no doubt. But I think he likes to have some sort of hurdle that he has to overcome, because I think it keeps him moving. I mean, think about how hard it is when you're winning a national championship as often as he does to find some new challenge. It's not like you can't really play the everybody doesn't believe in us card when you're picked to win the national championship every year. And so when he has these different challenges like NIL, I think it gives him a new hurdle that he has to work toward, that he has to figure out a solution around, and it gives him something else to have to work with. So I think we've seen some different famous college basketball coaches retire in the last 2 years or so. And I think it's at least been reported by other people that NIL played a factor in some of those guys wanting to walk away. I don't really see that with Saban. I mean, I could be wrong, but I see it more as a motivating factor for him to say, all right, this is how you guys want to play. Then, like, give me a year to figure it out, and I'm going to have an incredible operation that none of you guys are going to be able to match, which I think we're already starting to see that get built up.
Well, we've certainly seen that, you know, it hasn't stopped Dabo from wanting to play the underdog, poor little Clemson card, but it does seem like he gets less and less mileage out of it each year that they succeed. The comments about, you know, whenever he adapts and the hurry up, no huddle offense and things like that, it kind of reminds me how every time that we hear Saban, you know, kind of complaining about something, usually there's some Alabama fans in the comments that are saying, he's not just complaining, he's warning you that if that's where you want this to go, then he's going to do it, and he's going to do it better than you.
And they might eventually be wrong, but the track record suggests that they are right, you know, and because I think about it too, and again, it is because I think just the way he does things, he always gets accused of complaining and whining. And I would say he has definitely complained and whined about NIL in particular. And I've said this, I think, elsewhere, but his whole argument about, you know, the parity of college football to me does not make sense, because college football has never really had parity, first off. And secondly, one of the big reasons why he left the NFL for college football was he could capitalize on the fact that there isn't parity and he could stack all these top recruiting classes. But big picture wise, he is usually right about that. And I think back to even the transfer portal stuff. He has said from the get-go, I think this is bad for college football, but I'm telling you, it's not really going to hurt us. It's going to hurt a lot of other schools way more than it hurts us. And it's like, oh, Saban's complaining about the transfer portal, blah, blah, blah. Well, then look at this past year. He takes Georgia Tech star running back. He gets a really good wide receiver from Georgia. Gets a really good wide receiver from Louisville. Gets a transfer offensive lineman from Vanderbilt. I mean, he's taking starters from SEC schools and ACC schools, which is pretty much exactly what he warned was going to happen, was that top guys are way more likely to want to come to Alabama than to leave Alabama in the transfer portal.
Well, John, I just wanted to say this has been an excellent talk, and we know you've stayed a little bit longer than we initially had planned. We kind of played it a little loose, but I want to say how much we appreciated this. This was really intriguing, and for those of you out there, this book, if you've read an excerpt, The Leadership Secrets of Nick Saban, How Alabama's Coach Became the Greatest Ever, is just absolutely fascinating. And we'd love to hear in your words, John, how would you pitch this book to our audience?
Yeah, I should have had my elevator pitch down a little bit here, but I think that it appeals to a wide range of people. Because again, I think if you are a college football fan, if you're an SEC fan, Alabama fan, it doesn't really matter. You don't have to be an Alabama fan to enjoy this book. But again, if you are in any way a sports college football fan, there's going to be a lot in here that you've never heard before, you've never read before, that you're going to be fascinated by all these fun anecdotes and stories and just understanding why this guy does what he does. But also, I think no matter what you do, you know, I'm a journalist, but you could be a manager of a supermarket, you could be a CEO, whatever it is that you do in your professional life, I guarantee you there will be things in this book that you see that Saban does that you think, man, that makes a lot of sense to me. Like, I wonder if I could add that to my daily routine and be maybe even 1% better at what I do. And it definitely, you know, as a journalist, you always want to be impartial. You always want to have a little bit of that arm's distance from your subject. But as I wrote this book and talked to all these different people about Saban, I kept coming back to, like, a lot of what this guy does on a daily basis just makes a lot of sense. And there's a reason why he has had so much success. And so the big picture pitch is just that this is a incredibly easily accessible, easily read book that details the how and why Nick Saban has been the greatest college football coach of all time and how these things could easily be transferable into any field outside of just football. So I think no matter what your interest is, whether it's just football or just business or whatever, there's going to be something in this book that you're going to like.
Excellent. Well, thanks again, John. We really appreciate it. John Talty is a sports editor and SC Insider with the Alabama Media Group. He's got the book. We just talked about it. We've got a link that we put in our own feed to the Amazon for The Leadership Secrets of Nick Saban. It's real fun. I recommend it. We've enjoyed reading what the bits we have so far. It makes us want to read more about it, especially after listening to John. This is our CFB Talk. On behalf of myself, Bob Akhayeri, on behalf of Sirius, thank you for joining us. Have a great afternoon. Now, I'm going to hang up and listen.